You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
My name is Thomas O'Toole. I am the managing editor of the Bloomberg BNA Electronic Commerce and Law Report. We picked up the Bloomberg name about a year ago, but this publication has been in existence since 1995. We cover cyber law policy here in the nation's capital. Before we get going, I've got a few things I need to unpack here. First of all, I want to say that I am proud to be moderating the fourth annual Judith Krug Memorial Intellectual Freedom Panel. Judith Krug was the longtime director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom and executive director of the Freedom to Read Foundation. During her tenure, she dedicated her work to fighting censorship, including founding the first Banned Books Week in 1982. She was a longtime member of the Internet Education Foundation, and this panel today honors her memory. The title of the panel today is No Rest for the Wicked, Charting an Affirmative Plan for Safeguarding Internet Freedom. This is an issue that I think we could not have a better panel to discuss today. I will start with the panel introductions first. To my very, very far right is Fiona Alexander, who is Associate Administrator for the Department of Commerce's National Telecommunications and Information Office of International Affairs. A shorthand for that is she's in charge of international internet policy for the Department of Commerce. She oversees ICANN. She participates in the recent WICKET talks, and she is no doubt going to be a participant in the next iteration of those, which is going to be the World Telecommunications Policy Forum in Geneva coming up in May. To her left is Colin Crowell. Mr. Crowell is the head of global public policy at Twitter. He is a longtime public policy hand. He started way back with Representative Edward Markey, who has been interested in internet policy issues for as long as I've been on the scene. When did you work for Representative Markey? When did you start?
In D.C., 1989.
He's also been an advisor to the FCC Chair Julius Genachowski, and that's about all that has to be said about that. The next person to his left is Jamie Hedlund. Jamie joined ICANN 3 years ago, and he's the head of its Washington, D.C. office. He is VP for public policy in North America. Before joining ICANN, he served as Vice President for Regulatory Affairs at the Consumer Electronics Association, and before that, he led Yahoo's public policy efforts. Finally, to my immediate right, I'm not going to read all of this, is Andrew McLaughlin. Andrew, are you with Access or BetaWorks now?
BetaWorks. I chair the board at Access, but I have a job. That's
right.
What you're asking.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
thank you very much.
Andrew kind of reminds me of that character in Woody Allen's movie Zelig, where you see a picture of him at every important moment in history. I was looking at his bio. Andrew was involved in briefing the ACLU versus Reno case back in 1996. He then moved on to ICANN and was with it at the beginning. Is that correct? He next moved to Director of Global Public Policy at Google when Google was getting hot from the years 2004 to 2009. He then served President Obama in his White House. Next, he's moved on to Access and BetaWorks. Is that correct? Okay. So he goes way, way back, as far back as internet policy goes. It's my hope that today's panel will talk about what is internet freedom? Why is internet freedom important? What is the United States government's policy toward internet freedom? And what are we doing to advance it? And what should we be doing to advance it? And so I guess to start off, I want to call on Fiona to talk about, well, first to give her impression of what we mean when we talk about internet freedom, and then what your office is doing to advance it.
So I will apologize now. I'm recovering from a cold, like half of town, so I'll apologize now for the coughing. And we were going to be doing a very interactive discussion, as I recall, so I won't do very long remarks, but also a very interactive panel, but also a very interactive room, looking around the room, the people in the audience, I'm sure, all have questions they're dying to answer post-December, or ask and answer, probably. But in terms of what NTIA is doing and our set of issues, so when I think of internet freedom, it's sort of an amorphous term, and it can be anything and everyone, anything and everything to everyone. But we focus on over at NTIA is really sort of the idea of this multi-stakeholder model and making sure that whatever issue we're dealing with, whether it's an internet freedom issue in the sense of freedom of expression or free flow, or whether it's just traditional, what's been a traditional internet governance issue like domain names or privacy or anything that we do, we're all about the multi-stakeholder model. And for any of you that are very interested and have not heard this before, I would refer you to our website and to the plethora of speeches on our website from the head of our agency who outlines in great detail why this is the view of the administration. But just very succinctly, you know, we think that the multi-stakeholder model is more flexible. It's less subject to regulatory capture than traditional regulatory models. It involves everyone, which is important from our perspective, because then you allow all stakeholders to be involved and actually have a say in the process. And this is reflective of how the internet was developed and one of the reasons we think it's so successful. So, you know, I've been there for 12 years, but in the last 3 or 4 years, what we've really focused on is a couple of different things at NTIA, at least in my area of NTIA. One of those things was making sure that ICANN, and by the way, we don't oversee ICANN, we'll just clarify that statement from earlier, we're responsible for the U.S. government's relationship and participation in the ICANN process. And one of the things that we spent a lot of time doing over the last 4 years is really evolving our relationship with ICANN to make sure that it's not just the U.S. government or U.S. stakeholders, but that everyone is involved in the process and that stakeholders from around the world are participating. And one of those has been through the affirmation of commitments and these external review teams that have been evaluating ICANN's execution of its own tasks, and also renewed emphasis in our world on the role of the Government Advisory Committee and really being an active participant in the Government Advisory Committee on issues that are important to us. The other key issue I think that we've been focusing on at NTIA is deploying the multi-stakeholder model domestically on the key issue of privacy. The administration issued, I can't remember now how long ago, all the years run together for me, 6 months of the process, so there you go, I knew you would know. But prior to that, the administration issued a white paper, a blueprint for privacy, and one of the hallmarks and key points of that was to try to deploy these multi-stakeholder processes domestically. And NTIA has been involved for the last 6 months with stakeholders, many of you in the room, very actively involved in trying to develop a mobile apps code of conduct kind of construct. So that's one of the things we've been working on. And then internationally, I think, setting aside from sort of domain names and privacy, which are the two that I covered, we've been really focusing on how do we get the rest of the world to agree with us that this is the right approach, but actually try to use it. And for the first 2.5 years of the first term of the administration, we put a lot of emphasis in the OECD, and the output of that was these OECD internet policymaking principles. And the goal for that exercise was to get other governments in the OECD construct to actually say, look, this is the right approach. The multi-stakeholder model is the way we want to go. And this initiative was really important for us leading up to the wicket to make sure that we actually had a strong coalition that as opposed to past meetings where often the U.S. is often alone or has one or two key allies, what we saw in Dubai was a real strong coalition of people. And that is in large part, I think, to the reforms at ICANN and people participating in that process, people buying into the concept of the OECD principles and those kind of things. So going forward, I think just what we're focusing on is WICKIT is this is a post-WICKIT discussion, but WICKIT is not the end. It's not the beginning, and it's not the middle. I would argue that this sadly, this discussion is probably going on for another 20 or 30 years, keep everyone employed. But the WICKIT was one stop on the train of other governments wanting to have more of a say in the way that things work, and their preferred way of doing that and expressing that view is through intergovernmental mechanisms. So we have a variety of IT meetings coming up over the next 2 years. The next stop is in Geneva in May in the policy forum. And so what we're going to be continuing to do at NTIA is not just continue our participation in ICANN, and which we'll do, and continue to work through that process, continue to work our privacy privacy multi-stakeholder processes. Try to deploy these multi-stakeholder processes and other issues. We're looking forward. The department has an internet policy task force, which is looking at a series of other issues, not just privacy, but free flow, copyright, and cybersecurity. And we're looking to see if we can deploy this approach on cybersecurity again going forward this year. So we're going to be trying to, you know, not just say these things, but actually walk the walk and try to use these things domestically, which is hard. It's not easy, as our privacy process has shown. It takes time and dedication and real commitment to do that. So we're going to be continuing to do that. What we found out from the WICKIT process is that we've got two bigger picture geopolitical problems from my perspective. One, which is I think there's a lack of understanding of how existing processes work and how they've actually evolved and changed to accommodate some of the concerns that have been expressed in the last 10 years. So we're working with stakeholders to see if we can do that. And then the other real challenge I think that we have and that we need to sort of sit down and all put our heads together is how do you actually solve the real challenges of developing countries? It's fine for us to say use the multi-stakeholder process, but when they have a real practical issue, how do they actually deploy it and use it? And that's something that we're going to be doing going forward. So maybe not a direct answer to your question about what is internet freedom, but it's definitely a direct answer to what's on the NTIA agenda that sort of supports this concept going forward. So.
Okay. Andrew, how do you think the U.S. government is doing as far as advancing internet freedom? Do you think we're walking the talk? Do you think we're leading here? You know, and what more could we be doing if we're not?
So I think it's helpful to break internet freedom down into two things. Broadly speaking, the two issues that constitute internet freedom are censorship and surveillance. Those are the two governmental practices and sometimes company practices that inhibit people's ability to act freely on the internet. So censorship is restrictions around what you can say and do, and surveillance is the government watching what you're doing and in many cases taking punitive action, arrest and detention in some countries and other kinds of consequences in other countries. And so I give the U.S. really high marks on censorship. I think we have a fabulous legal framework with our First Amendment. It's sometimes difficult to explain to the rest of the world how it works here and why it works the way that it does and why permitting things like hate speech is an important part of our value system. But nevertheless, the U.S. government, I think, has acted consistently across administrations and across parties to advance the notion of free speech. I think where it's a little bit trickier and it's more difficult for us to be a good advocate is around surveillance. The big issue around surveillance is not whether the U.S. acts well or badly. I actually think that the U.S. has an impressive framework of oversight of our surveillance activities. And by the way, I think that more so having been in the White House for 2 years and watching a lot of that close up than I did beforehand. I think I would have been a bit more skeptical and cynical before I went in. But having watched it in operation, I actually found myself being awfully impressed with the extent to which the legal protections that we have on the books are borne out in practice. Now, it's not always the case. The Bush administration engaged in lawless, warrantless wiretapping, and the carriers that worked with them on that and the people who executed that program have all gotten off scot-free. So it's not like I think that we're perfect on this score. Our systems are flawed and can be prone to abuse as well. Nevertheless, what we have and what other countries often don't buy that we have is a genuine process of rule of law, and many countries don't have that. Even imperfect as ours is, it's at the heart of what the American system should stand for and be proud of, and it's our advocacy around that we are less credible on. Part of the reason for that, by the way, is because we engage in very active surveillance of networks outside the United States under the FISA statute, which, as everybody I'm sure here knows, is different from Title III and the legal requirements that go along with domestic surveillance. So for all of those reasons, that's one's a little bit trickier. But broadly speaking, I think the U.S. does a pretty good job. And let me just say another really important sort of helpful way to be thinking about these different issues is to keep in mind your mental stack, your multi-layer stack of the technology of the communications networks that bind the world together. So there are censorship and surveillance issues at the physical infrastructure layer. In other words, literally what equipment is deployed where.
that's able to block or sniff what's happening on the network. There's the logical layer, which are the standards and protocols that unify the IP and increasingly all of the telephony networks around the world. And then finally, there are the applications, and above them, the politics and religion layers, layers 8 and 9 in the 7-layer stack, that are sort of at issue. And you can look at each one of those layers and analyze who are the actors, what are the practices, and what are the things the United States needs to be worried about. And I think that we very often conflate them and confuse them. And so, you know, the ITU, for example, really has no role at the physical infrastructure layer. Like, people will write headlines and they'll write news stories that say, oh, the ITU is going to take over the internet. Well, you know, to quote, I think it might have been Stalin talking about the Pope, like, how many DNS root name servers does the ITU have? Like, none. It can't inject itself into the world of the DNS if it wants to, and so it's not a place to worry about it. Where the ITU is a threat, and why I think it should be wound down over the next coming years, is at the level of politics, norms, and practices that governments spread amongst each other. And there I think the U.S. has been very principled. We've taken a very active role. And I would hope that we will now shift from a simple containment strategy with the ITU to an active rollback strategy where our goal is to shrink sever the vestigial organs and limbs of the ITU that are no longer needed in our global communications infrastructure.
I'm just on that to follow up with you. How do we accomplish that in your view?
Diplomacy, 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 diplomacy. And a whole bunch of other supporting activities that will make people comfortable with the argument that we're making. The big thing that we run into in taking on the ITU is that as part of the broad UN family, the ITU is seen as part of multinational, internationalist, cooperative activities that most people in the world, including the U.S., typically like. We have a long history of kind of running headlong at UN agencies when they annoy us, or even the WTO, which, by the way, we started as soon as they ruled against us on online gambling. We've now decided maybe we don't want to, you know, adhere to anymore. And so our unilateralist past haunts us in this ITU debate. Nevertheless, it doesn't mean, even if you're an internationalist, that everything the UN does is wonderful. I mean, just ask the $8 billion stolen from the Oil for Food program in Iraq and ask them, you know, how well the UN worked for them there. So the way to do that, I think, is vigorous diplomacy around building support for the notion that the United States is attempting to vindicate a set of interests that are shared by especially young people and internet users around the world. Those are the people that we're standing up for, the upstarts, the ISPs, not the incumbents, the innovators and the entrepreneurs, not the big corporate entities that dominate many of the economies in the developing world. In addition, I think part of what the U.S. Needs to be getting credit for is the fact that so many of our companies are building communications infrastructure and investing in communications infrastructure around the world to obviate their sense of the unfairness and imbalances that often lie at the heart of a sort of a geopolitical resentment of the United States. And then finally, I would like to see the United States, I think, and by the way, I think this is part of the U.S. strategy, doing more to align itself politically with those interests in an economic sense. And that means, you know, the way in which we open ourselves to trade and investment here domestically can speak volumes about our willingness to act as a peer and a partner, not simply a sort of a dominant economic power. I don't know if that's too vague, but that's what I think.
Colin, how does this internet freedom debate look from Twitter's perspective?
Well, we obviously run a global open platform, and so as a result, we are a service that is accessible in most places in the world where you can get a signal and some connection to the internet. So it's important to millions of our users around the world. As half of a two-person public policy team, neither of which was in Dubai for the Wicket process, this was something that we were obviously monitoring and looking closely at. I do recall, as a Hill staffer on the House Telecommunications Subcommittee, organizing several hearings on what would eventually become ICANN, and that initial early sort of embryonic processes that led to the multi-stakeholder approach that people are now discussing. And it wasn't without growing pains, and it wasn't without a little wandering this way and then wandering back that way as different entities within the government, different stakeholders in the internet sector found a way to find something that generally works. And I remember at one of the early hearings, my boss, Congressman Markey, who was chairing it at the time, sort of described ICANN in that era with the quip that Churchill had about democracy, in that it was the worst form of government, excepting, of course, all other forms of government. And that is sort of where it was at the time. It was what we had. You looked at all the other alternatives, and they all seemed worse. And so you had to go through that process of perfecting. And I remember, and Andrew will remember this in particular, in the early days, ICANN making real efforts to increase participation among a variety of stakeholders beyond the natural stakeholders in where the internet was most dominant, which was the United States. And so early ICANN meetings were in Africa, in South America, in Asia, in places where they thought they could draw other folks in the world with interest and brought that diversity to that process. And I think what we saw in the WICKET process was something that Andrew alluded to as well, which is that across the world, and largely in the younger demographic, there is intense interest in these questions, in what they consider to be their internet, that it is sort of a held in collective, and it's precious, and where it goes and how it's treated and the norms of conduct on that are very important to them.
I think I've heard from everybody who's spoken so far a defense of multi-stakeholderism as an alternative to government regulation in advancing internet freedom. Yet, it seems to me that these multi-stakeholder groups have a great deal of difficulty grappling with some of these policy issues like privacy, which Fiona mentioned, and cybersecurity. Jamie, is there anything in your experience with ICANN that would give you confidence that multi-stakeholderism is a way to go or an alternative to the ITU as far as advancing internet freedom, advancing privacy? I mean, it's got to be tough when you go through all of your long, drawn-out multi-stakeholder processes and someone from the government just says, no, we don't like it.
Right. So just a couple things about ICANN. We were or are one of the original multi-stakeholder organizations. The United States, you know, gave two major gifts to the world. One was the internet, and the other was the idea of multi-stakeholder governance. And our remit, though, is fairly limited. It's related to coordinating technical functions on the internet, names, addresses, and sort of internet standards, and then a registry of internet standards, and then secondly, coordinating the policy development related, reasonably related to that. So we don't, ICANN, the multi-stakeholder groups that come together to meet at ICANN, and ICANN, the organization itself, we don't touch on issues of digital freedom or on issues of content generally or privacy. What I can say is that, picking off on Colin's reference to Churchill, I mean, it is because you have representatives of private industry, you have representatives of government, you have representatives of civil society, of academia, and the technical community there. You will, in the end, go through what is often a messy process, but at the end of the day, you will end up in a better place than you would if only one stakeholder, whether it was just private sector or just government, were there developing policies related to that.
So, you know, just to add on to that, multi-stakeholder processes are a catastrophe if the people participating aren't well tailored to the mission, right? So one of the things that's interesting about ICANN is that, especially in the early years, and I think still, we were like constantly just trying to narrow the problem set. You know, like all we got to do is like publish a root zone file, listing name server, IP addresses, and, you know, top-level domains, and that's it. Like, that's all we're doing. And so everybody just buzz off, you know, and, like, just do other stuff. Like, let us worry about this stuff. The problem is that two things. One, human beings invest semantic meaning and political, religious, ethnic, and other kinds of significance in names. Literally, the, you know, strings of characters have meaning, and therefore it's things that people fight over. So, for example, you know, who should run .cashmere? Well, you know, people fight wars over that. And so it has meaning, and so you have to do that kind of stuff. And then the second thing is that there are sort of nationalistic, if that's the right word for it, but kind of geopolitical interests in dignity and in equal weight and value of different countries and peoples and so forth that makes them want their voice to be equal regardless of what the question is. And so these two forces kind of converge on ICANN and make it very difficult to run a multi-stakeholder process. But for all the Churchillian reasons that have been cited, it's important to try to make it work, and I think that's what you've tried to do. Broadly, when you look at what's so screwy about the ITU, it's that a government-to-government decision-making body is now completely ill-suited to the questions about how the communications networks of the world run. Partly because so many governments are terrible on these issues. They are horrible on censorship. They do terrible things with surveillance. And so for that reason, they're a mismatch with the needs of the broad user population of the world on these communication networks. And then the second reason is that the old infrastructure that the ITU was built for is now dead. So the old standardized PSTN infrastructure that needed government-to-government agreement so the wires connected together and everybody was interconnected is done because we have TCP/IP. We have better alternatives that come out of standards bodies that were non-governmental. And even on an issue like cybersecurity, there is no way to have an effective set of practices around cybersecurity that is not fundamentally rooted in the engineers and the network operators that are actually running the routers. Those are the people and the software writers whose packets flow over those networks. Those are the people that need to be in the conversation, almost none of whom work for governments.
So just picking up on one part of it, you know, completely agree with everything you've said about the issue with an IGO working on these kinds of issues exclusively. But one thing we've learned at ICANN is it's also really important to our credibility. In fact, it's critical to our credibility that governments feel like they have an effective voice within the multi-stakeholder process. A lot of times it's, you know, sort of pitted as multi-stakeholder or government only, but it's really important to point out that within ICANN, governments play a very strong role through the Governmental Advisory Committee, which is you know, it's a constituency of 120 plus governments who advise the board on policy. Where we saw this in action most recently was in the approval of the new generic top-level domain program. That program did not get approved and launched until a pretty extensive thorough 6-month process of a consultation with the board and the Governmental Advisory Committee. The Governmental Advisory Committee had 12 areas. They, you know, it was really some 90 issues, and 90% of them, the governments and the Governmental Advisory Committee and the board reached an accommodation. For a lot of governments around the world, that was success. For some governments around the world, they didn't get 100, and so it was a failure. But it is really critical that the governments feel they have an effective voice within ICANN. Not a dominant voice, not a, you know, exclusive voice, not a veto, but that they have a role. The other issue, the other problem with government only organizations defining internet policy is that, you know, governments broadly don't always understand the technology. There are people in governments who do understand it, but they don't always have the loudest voice. And so it's really important what you're saying. that experts from the technical community as well have as much a voice in these discussions as government.
Fiona, question to you. I've heard from almost all the panelists now that the ITU, in their opinion, doesn't really have a meaningful or a constructive role to play in internet freedom, and yet there are all these internet governance events that are coming up, and the government is going to go. What should the government's policy be toward these events? I mean, you're not going to negotiate the marginalization of the ITU at the ITU's own events, I wouldn't think. Is it plausible to consider expanding ICANN's remit? Is the GAC or some successor to the GAC a better venue for solving some of these issues? And I guess some of these meaning internet freedom, privacy, cybersecurity, access.
So these are all a lot of very complicated questions all rolled up in one nice bow. I think it's important to keep in mind that the ITU is not a monolithic institution. There are three different parts to it. So there's a radio sector, a development sector, and a standards sector. And a majority of this conversation, I think, has been about the standards sector. Until there's another place for governments to coordinate spectrum policy, which is important for a lot of different, national defense, for economic growth, for all these things, until there's another place to coordinate spectrum policy, the ITUR is an important part, of any U.S. agenda. The development sector, in the same regard, we try to be proactive there, but a lot of countries look for a one-stop shop, and they look for the ITU for that place to be. So the development sector is the place, I think, that will continue to go. So I think it's important that when we talk about the ITU, not say it's just one big, it's one umbrella institution, but it has three different, possibly four parts if you look at the secretariat. So this is about the standards processes and the fact that, as Andrew's pointed out, the ITU, at least from the standard side, was developed, not even for the telephone system, for the telegraph system.
That's true.
And has evolved over time. And at the time when it was for the telephone system, it was when most telephone systems were government-owned monopolies. So it made sense for governments to go into the room and for governments to vote and for governments to negotiate these things. The world has changed. The time has changed. The Internet has changed things. The IETF, other W3C, other standards-making processes have evolved that involve all stakeholders and do it differently. And the question is, what's the role for the ITU in that area? And I think that's something, that we've been considering for a while in the United States, not just in government, but, consulting with other stakeholders through different processes that the State Department and others run. It's something that we'll do leading up to the next plenipotentiary conference, which is in October or November of 2014. This is the every four-year conference where the ITU gets together and rewrites its rules of procedure and mandates. And this, we'll start, as we in the next few months, preparing for that. That's the meeting where the United States will say, here's what we want from this institution. Here are the rules that we want to see. Here's the amount of money we're willing to pay into this institution. So all the issues that are being raised are very timely and can paint that process. But this is the time for us to start having that conversation. But again, I think it's important not to say that the institution is one thing because it can be different pieces. With respect to expanding the role of ICANN, I don't think that that's something that we would support as the United States, at least at NTIA. I'm not sure that's something ICANN itself would want to do. To Andrew's point, I think it's always been the reality that people look at the Internet, they look at Internet policy issues, they're complicated, they're looking for a place to have a conversation, they're looking for an organized process. Sadly, or rightly or wrongly, the domain name system, because of the ICANN setup, has been one of the most organized places to have policy conversation, and it's often a target of where we should do things or not do things. But I think keeping ICANN focused on what it does is probably still its best thing for it for the long term, but also from what we would want to do as well. That does leave these real issues of internet policy and where do you do them. One of the outputs of this UN World Summit a few years ago was the creation of the Internet Governance Forum. And the Internet Governance Forum brings together stakeholders from around the world and talks about policy issues. Organically spawning from that were local and regional Internet Governance Forums. We actually have a U.S. Internet Governance Forum. It's usually in May. And then regional ones. And those have really been focusing on bringing people together in a way that they hadn't talked before. And maybe that's the place where you can, have more of those conversations. But that's our real challenge going forward is where can governments go? And where can governments feel comfortable having these conversations? It's taken 12 years, 14, how long has ICANN been around?
It's 99.
14 years to even get, I think, governments and a large number of governments to actively participate in ICANN. And it's true for governments to have an effective role within the ICANN space, as opposed to governments deciding and dictating through rules or laws or regulation. So I think we're going to have to look at these other issues, and we're going to have to look at them a little bit one by one and figure out what's the best place to address some of these issues.
Okay. The organizers of this State of the Net conference put up a video from a member of European Parliament, I hope I pronounced her name right, Marika Shaka, thank you, Andrew. And she spoke in favor of a digital agenda for Europe, where Europe will recognize that digital access and internet freedom are core components of human rights, and they are going to walk the talk as well. And she is calling for Europe to include conditions in trade contracts that internet freedom will be respected with their trading partners. She's calling for digital evidence to be more broadly admissible. I don't think we have a problem with that here. But also that technologies, there should be restrictions on technologies that can be used for oppression. Colin, do you think there's a helpful role for Congress to get involved in a similar digital agenda? And sort of what's your sense of Congress's willingness to do that, whether that's helpful?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's too early in this particular Congress to know really what their respective committee agendas may be. But I do think historically one of the best roles of Congress is that oversight ability to ask questions and generate the public commentary on issues that are natural during a time of transition. I think asking questions about surveillance technologies, I think asking questions about where the contours of freedom of expression begin and end. I think we have a healthy debate that began in the previous Congress about ECPA reform and civil protections on the internet. And some of these are simply about making sure that we keep pace with the changes in technology, that the rapid technological change ensures that some of the things that we may have taken for granted or secured in a previous era that we still value and cherish are retained. And that's, I think ECPA reform is a good example of that. And so, yeah, so I do think you can go down a list of things where I think Congress raising the issue, raising the question. I think what member of Parliament talked about was really a suite of different issues under a broad umbrella in that respect.
Do you have any sense whether Congress is willing to do that this term, a sense of what might be coming down the pike? I have heard that there will be some hearings about multi-stakeholderism in general, probably in the privacy area, but...
Yeah, you know. I think in the early going, historically, you'll hear a lot of interest on a wide variety of issues, and I have learned historically to wait until the hearings are actually scheduled before adhering to the Vegas line on what's going to actually happen or not happen.
Does anyone on this panel, I'll just throw it open to you, think that any good could come of an international treaty effort similar to the ACTA treaty effort, which was focused on copyright enforcement but could easily have been focused on internet security or internet access or internet freedom, to instead of always playing defense on these issues, to come forward and to try to export this?
So the short answer is no. There is no good that can come of an international treaty process about any of those issues. Actually, can I just say, this is another second one of these I've come back to since leaving government. And before that, I was always working at Google or at ICANN, where I had to have restrained opinions. It's great. I love these things now. So anyway, the short answer is no good can come of it. And ACTA is a great example. So internet freedom is in tension with copyright protection. In one conception of copyright protection, there are other ways to think about it, but Hollywood and the recording industry have decided that what they need is exactly the same kind of censorware controls over the network in order to stop copyright infringement as the Chinese government wants in order to stop dissidents from expressing their views about the Communist Party. That's unfortunate. I think there's lots of other ways to vindicate copyright, but they made that choice. And the ACTA debates have largely been, on the internet chapter anyway, a quarrel over the extent to which free flows of information mandates to lock down and control networks in order to, or give governments the ability to lock down and control networks in order to stop copyright infringement. So, so in that sense, I think like very little good can come of it. On the cybersecurity area and sort of more broadly on internet freedom outside of the trade context, the answer again is sort of like hell no, because so many governments have views that are abhorrent. And by the way, it's not just the Syrians and Irans, but governments like France and Germany and Australia, Brazil, all of these, India, all of these are democratic states and deeply democratic cultures that have reached different judgments about free speech than we have. In Germany, for their historical reasons, obviously, they believe as and have consistently revalidated over the decades the notion that Nazi speech, Holocaust denial, hate speech of any kind is just off the table, and even if they know it's ineffective in the internet era as a cultural matter, it's important to them to keep revalidating that. And so lots of other countries have free speech traditions which are a ton worse than ours, so any kind of international treaty is going to be worse than our current state right now, so what's the point? On cybersecurity, it is absolutely the case that countries like Russia and China have define security to mean tools that allow them to control information they don't like, as opposed to the way we think about it, which is controls to stop people from stealing stuff that they don't rightly have access to. And so once again, like it's a different sort of a thing. It'd be impossible to try to iron that out, and the world would be left worse off than it is now.
So Fiona? I think the reality of a treaty-making process is fundamentally it's government-to-government negotiations and just preparing as one government of 193. First of all, you can be outvoted very easily. And as we saw in Dubai, votes happen even though they're not supposed to happen, but there are rules for voting. But just practically speaking, it'd be government to government. All the people that are actually involved in the creation of the infrastructure that run it, that use it, would have no say. And that's completely anathema to everything that we believe with respect to the internet. So why would we want to put ourselves in a situation where only governments could speak, only governments could make the rules, and we would be faced, you know, in many cases where we don't have a lot of support and allies. And as you go into any negotiation, you have to decide what's going to be your give, what's your consensus point. And are there any of our principles that we're willing to give? We're not willing to negotiate the First Amendment. So there's nothing good to come from that.
And let me just add one thing to that, which is in parallel, though, we are engaged in free trade negotiations. And that's a good thing. It's very good for our country. Free trade is enormously productive for the United States and our economy. And as part of those negotiations, the U.S. has been inching closer and closer to what I would regard as kind of full-throated and vigorous advocacy for free flows of information as part of either bilateral one-to-one agreements, plurilateral agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or even full, you know, multilateral agreements like the instruments that surround the World Trade Organization. So one of the things that I would like to see the administration do, and where I think an affirmative agenda can come to fruition, is to much more forcefully advocate for free flows of information to be instantiated in these agreements. The best approach, which is subject to the metering of the sort of meager number of agreements that we have in process, is to pick the most favorable trading partners, instantiate free flows of information language into those agreements where it's easiest, and slowly build the bricks over decades that you can use to make this a part of the multilateral trading system. But we have to do that sort of case by case, and we have to be willing to take off the table censorship tools for the purpose of copyright vindication. And if we're willing to do that, then we can be a truly, you know, compelling force for internet freedom through trade. By the way, it has the beautiful domestic political benefit that it unites all of the American information industries that would like to have full and unfettered access to global markets, which includes movies, includes music, and includes TV, many of which are restricted in their distribution in other countries and for which the internet is potentially an unrestricted medium of distribution.
Does anybody else want to comment on that? No. I feel like I haven't heard from you enough, Jamie. Can you talk just a little bit about sort of what you think Congress can do to support these multi-stakeholder processes that I'm hearing are a preferred alternative to international government action?
So I don't have any prescriptions for Congress. What I can say is Congress has been very supportive of the multi-stakeholder approach. They passed a resolution shortly before the wicket, and they have long been supportive of the multi-stakeholder approach to internet and an open and private sector-led internet. So and that's good. Where we sometimes end up in trouble is not just with with any governmental body deciding that there is a specific issue that it wants to tackle on the internet, and deciding as a government that's the method that should be implemented. That's fortunately very rare, I think where the U.S. government can, and other governments traditionally had a similar view of the internet economy as our government, is in the developing world, and I think that is where there's the U.S. and its allies on one end, there's China, Russia, some others at another end. And in the middle, there are a number of countries who are trying to make up their mind, and some have seen already hints of the benefits of an open internet. And I think where those countries that have already seen incredible economic and communications gains as a result of the internet can really help is going to the developing world and answering, as Fiona suggested, helping them solve real problems that they have. Making governments comfortable with this multi-stakeholder model, because it's not a natural place for governments in which to sit, and I think that will, over the long term, that will win the game for the multi-stakeholder approach.
Okay, we're now under 10 minutes left to go in this hour, so if anyone has any questions they'd like to ask this panel, now is the time to rise and approach the microphone. Identify yourself, please.
My name is Brad White, and I'm with ICANN. Colin, I had a question for you. You were talking about the oversight hearings on the Hill. It strikes me, last year, for example, there were hearings on both the House side and the Senate side dealing with the new GTLD program. This year, there's an overwhelming passage of a resolution supporting the multi-stakeholder model. Yet last year, during those GTLD hearings, there was a lot of questioning about the seven-year process, multi-stakeholder process, that had led to that new G program. And I wonder how that plays overseas. The government seems to, on one hand, say we support the multi-stakeholder model. On the other hand, the multi-stakeholder model produced a program they weren't happy with, so ICANN calls us up on both sides of Congress. Is there mixed messaging going out there?
No, I think that's the nature of the democratic way. That you're going to have certain opportunities for stakeholders who feel aggrieved by a particular decision to seek a forum in which to air that out again and have somebody question it publicly. And, that I think is perfectly healthy. The fact that the multi-stakeholder process leads to things which are not clean, that may be provocative, that could be further perfected. I have seen oftentimes that the congressional oversight processes that don't lead to any new laws or resolutions or anything passing Congress, but do lead organizations and companies and entities to go back and think again about how they were doing something in ways that can help refine that process. I think one of the benefits of the entire story was the fact that in a Congress that had rare cases of consensus, that one of the key pieces of consensus was how the United States should then turn and pivot internationally with respect to its international role and speak with a relatively united voice across the political spectrum and across all of the different stakeholders who might have quibbled with a judgment or a decision that the organization was making, but is united in what they did not want to see at the Wicket. So,
hi, I'm Eli Dorado. I'm an academic at George Mason University, and I was a member of the Wicket delegation. And on the side, I run a little website called Wicket Leaks. And so my experience...
Great site, by the way. Clever name. Like, once you thought of the name, you had to build it, right?
Yeah, so my colleague Jerry Brito thought of the name, and he came into my office and told me, and we're like, okay, we're building it. So we built it that day. So my experience of being in Dubai and running Wicket Leaks has made me wonder if there's not actually a third element to a third alliterative word you could add to your list, Andrew, of censorship and surveillance and secrecy. So I think that it's important that the institutions that govern the Internet and that affect how the Internet works are transparent. And I think that we saw it even at Wicket, sort of with the multi-regional proposal that was threatened, that came out it was threatened on Friday night. And then so we got our hands on it on Saturday and we tweeted it. And Egypt had to recant almost immediately because... it started circulating in the Egyptian Twitterverse. So I just wonder if anybody has comments about how we could use the transparency norm to affect internet.
I think it's a great point. I think this notion of transparency, not just in ensuring that people have a window into what's afoot at different multi-stakeholder processes. It's hard to feel like you're a legitimate stakeholder with an authentic voice in that process if you feel like you don't have all the information you need to participate and form judgments about stuff. I will say that, you know, the transparency notion is important on, you know, not just in that sense, but also on the censorship surveillance notions that Andrew mentioned earlier. Google has produced something which we at Twitter now emulate, which is a transparency report that tracks government requests for user information for the removal of content. And they've been doing it for a number of years, and it's quite good. And we did our first at Twitter in July. We're endeavoring to do them every 6 months. Again, to provide some transparency into what we're receiving, how we're handling it, which then also shines a light on how governments are interacting with us. And as I said, Google began that. We will do our second installment of that relatively soon. But I think that's another important transparency piece that companies like ours and others can assist in providing that window into what's happening.
And can I just add, I think part of the joy and the moral imperative of trying to take down the ITU is that it operates in a horrific fashion. Its processes are horrifyingly secretive, transparent, and the results are distorted by what I think of as this kind of like soft nexus of corruption that pervades the place, which is not to say cash passing from hand to hand, although, you know, who knows, maybe that does happen somewhere in the IT universe. But it's the revolving door of regulators going to their state-owned monopolists or former state-owned monopolists. It's government officials feeding at the trough of trips to Geneva a couple times a year and, you know, basically having a lifestyle funded by this vestigial dinosaur of an organization that's no longer needed. So I think part of what's beautiful about the internet community generally, across both parties, rallying to try to supplant the ITU, the bits of, and as Fiona keeps pointing out, you know, there are bits of the ITU that are still useful. It still maintains, by the way, a table of telephone dialing codes, although it can't even get that right because it still screws up the Taiwan listing because of politics. But anyway, but there are some things that it does right. But the bits that it are not needed, which is to say standards, policy, and the mimetic transposition of evil and bad practices around the world, those are things that by taking them on, what the United States is doing and what our internet community is doing is aligning itself with the younger generations in places like Kenya, Brazil, and India, for whom their governments are their local ITUs that operate in a non-transparent, secretive fashion. And I have to say as a footnote, the United States, if it's ever going to have any leg to stand on in this area, has got to itself embrace transparency when it negotiates things like ACTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I can say as a White House staffer, I was embarrassed, I was ashamed at how meagerly and begrudgingly we went down the road of transparency ourselves. I think we could do a lot better, and I hope the second Obama term will see us do a lot better in that area, although I don't hold out a lot of hope. The bureaucracies of trade negotiation are very entrenched and very difficult to overcome.
Hi, my name is Mustafa Naseem. I'm a graduate student at Colorado and currently interning at Verizon. First of all, I was very thankful for WikiLeaks. Gave us the agenda for Wikid, which I must say wasn't available for publicly, even for academic use. My question is to Fiona. One of the items on the agenda was what ITU could use, could do in terms of bringing development to developing countries with the revolution in communication. And so I'm wondering if the U.S. has any stance on it, or what was decided, or how the U.S. plans to go forward, given the fact that a lot of the revolution that has happened is bringing money out from developing countries into developed countries, as a lot of the startups are based out of the U.S. and the users are in developing countries.
I think the U.S. development agenda is probably a panel in and of itself, and I think one we probably need to get a better handle around. I mean, we do a fair amount of development aid through USAID and a few other things. And as Andrew pointed out, there's a lot of U.S. companies that do great work that is not marshaled and pulled together. And I think one of the things that we'll be looking forward to in the next year, especially as we sort of lead up to next year's plenipotentiary, is really sort of figuring out what really is our development strategy, because I'm not sure that it's all that cohesive. And I mean, I think that's a fair comment.
I could ask Andrew a question because he's the one that is not related to any of the companies and organizations that I'm related with. I'm Veni Markovsky, I'm VP of ICANN for Russia and Eastern Europe. One issue which we have in this part of the world is that the term internet governance cannot be translated in some of the languages of the world. So when people talk about internet governance here, we understand one item, and this is the multi-stakeholder approach, et cetera, et cetera. They replace it immediately with governments. So, Andrew, in your multiple, past, do you think that there is a way for us actually to reach out and try to explain how the internet works? Many of the people, you talked about the ITU corruption. I think it's not corruption. I think actually it's lack of competence. Many of the people who go there are actually people who want to know how the internet functions, but they read the documents produced by the ITU because that's their relevant source of information. And these documents many times are not quite correct. And do you think that there is something where we could, as organizations that are here or just individuals, help?
Well, so this is something I think that's of fundamental importance. And let me just say, not just in developing countries. I mean, so, Fiona's been with me at a bunch of these meetings. One of the things that I worked with colleagues to do when I was in the White House was we kept having these cybersecurity meetings in, classified facilities, table of 30 people, lots of people that have the prefix cyber in their job title somewhere, and populated with people of jaw-dropping lack of understanding about how the network actually works. And so what we sort of worked our way through was this exercise where anytime we'd be talking about a cybersecurity issue, we would force people to locate it at a point on a stack and in a topology, meaning are we talking about Stuxnet, right? Or you want to take the Configure worm, right? So Configure. So what is Configure? Well, it affects either physical infrastructure or the software that runs on it or standards or applications. Like, what is it? And then you also have to isolate, is it infecting end devices, routers, core equipment? Like what? You get a much better discussion once you can say this particular issue, you know, if it's Configer, is an operating system end of, you know, it's at the end devices and operating systems, and that's where the problem is. Then you can figure out who are the players that need to be in the room and what conversations do you need to have. And fundamentally, cybersecurity is just a bunch of conversations, and so that helps you figure it out. So it is a perennial problem, Venny. I know you've done yeoman's work to try to fix it, but we are still, I think, in early days of the kind of Cambrian explosion of, you know, devices and software and everything else that's that the internet is bringing. And so we need to be incredibly energetic about trying to figure out how to explain this very different network. The internet is not just a new version of the telephone system. It is a fundamentally different architecture. It's a fundamentally different set of power relationships that flow from that. They are very encouraging. We should be optimistic about them. But they need that kind of education and explanation for people to understand what it is they're talking about to make good judgments about it.
One more question. Steve?
Thanks. I think that multi-stakeholder processes are doomed to fail if the participants think they can skip the consensus and compromise and just cut a better deal with Congress, with the government, or a higher body. And I think that's what's plaguing us in the NTIA multi-stakeholder privacy process. So the question is, has the ITU gained sufficient momentum at Dubai to where governments that favor surveillance or censorship can now, well, skip the hard work of ICANN multi-stakeholder process and instead use the ITU as the body they would go to get their way, because that will diminish their commitment to participate in the GAC at ICANN.
Fiona, do you think the ITU jeopardizes ICANN?
I don't think the results of Dubai do that, which you've described. I do think that it's a constant threat of and it's not just governments. I think any stakeholder group, including some of you in the room, when you don't like the results of a process you participate in, you naturally and rightly so go to somebody else to try to help. I think the question is long-term, what's the collateral damage to the system if you do that too often and too frequently? You know, the question that Brad asked about the hearings, you know, I have no problem answering questions to what we do. I think it's important part of our role of government and oversight. It is really hard to explain to other colleagues why Congress is having a hearing on something and we're up there defending ICANN and someone in Congress is seeming to be not. And that's very challenging to explain to other parts of the world that don't have our same type of democracy, that don't have a separation of powers the way that we do. I mean, the messaging and the nuance, it gets the more international you go, the higher level of talking point you need. And it just becomes more and more challenging. But I do think that we all have to be vigilant. I think everyone needs to sort of redouble their efforts to participate in the processes to get them right, to make them work. I think those countries that are not happy with the multi-stakeholder model, which has to have these standards of transparency and participation and accountability, I mean, they all have to have that or they're not acceptable. And those are some of the changes ICANN has been going through over the last 5 years. But it's always going to be acceptable to a certain part of – there are certain core governments this model is never going to work for. I think that's the reality of the world that we live in, and we have to continue to be vigilant and continue to fight that fight. But it's this middle group of countries that are looking for what's the right way, how do I do it, you know, as Andrew spoke about sort of the countries where you've had this explosion of internet freedom, where you've had these revolutions, where you have young people that are really doing something, that's where we should be focusing. And I think that needs to really be the shifting of our focus going forward.
Okay, I think that's a good place to end. Thank you, panel. Thank you, Stay the Net organizers. Thank you, audience.